Welcome, Tom. It's so great to have you with us today.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Well, the book is now published and getting strong reviews. Sebastian Junger said it was, and I quote, "one of the best disaster books I've ever read. I tore through it like a novel, but with the queasy knowledge that the whole damn thing is true. A phenomenal feat of journalism." Wow.
Yeah, and they come in from him. That made my week, I'll tell you.
I bet. We spoke last October. You shared your incredibly tight schedule. Can you share your writing and research experience with our listeners? What was it like?
Well, I kind of am embarrassed to admit, but I guess like a lot of people, I knew nothing about offshore oil drilling. And I had this idea that there were these platforms that were kind of built on pylons that went all the way down to the bottom, and that these people just sort of sat out there doing nothing but drilling for like, you know, God knows how long at a time. And I knew nothing about the people who did it. I knew nothing about the technology. I didn't even think about, you know, how hard is it to try to drill a hole when you can't even start until you're a mile under the water? And so the process of me learning how all this happened, in fact, these aren't platforms that are sort of attached to the ground. Of course, you know, a mile through the water is way too long for that. And they're, what they are, is sophisticated ships that can hover over one spot using this incredibly sophisticated computer-generated thrust, and these immense platforms that are like the size of two football fields put together, and multiple decks, and has something like a hotel and an office building that are hanging down from the main deck, and that these people, you know, like there, in this case, there are 127 people on board, and that they form this kind of community where it's almost like a band of brothers. They're out there for 3 weeks at a time. They learn to really depend on each other. They're proud of this unbelievable feat that they're doing. You know, you're starting a mile below the ocean, and then you're drilling down another 18 or 20,000 feet. And you're doing it all at the end. You know, basically, nobody can go down that far. You know, a mile below the ocean is further even than a nuclear sub can go. So imagine the difficulty of starting there and trying to then drill down 18,000 feet through, you know, all sorts of different conditions. And so I had to, it seems like every technique that they use is something that the lay people know nothing about. And so even when they're defining what they do, even when they sort of explain what they do, they're using vocabulary words that I never heard before. So every time they define something, I had to get 20 other definitions in order to understand the first definition.
So there's actually men and women who work on the rig.
Well, I mean, it used to be almost exclusively men. Now there are some women, and there was a woman who figured prominently, but it's still an incredibly male-dominated culture. And since the whole thing is in the Gulf, and that draws mainly from the South, it is really a good old boy dominated culture still. But then they have to have all these sailors, these trained sailors, from maritime academies around the country, and these very highly educated engineers who do this incredible technology to do the drilling. And they're from all around the country. So there's and that's part of what I discovered and what I wrote about, is that there's this culture clash between, you know, anybody who lives north of I-10 and everybody else. And they have to learn how to get along and to make things work under these, you know, conditions where they're out in the middle of nowhere on this very, very tiny island, working 12-hour shifts 7 days a week. It was like a moon launch, really. I mean, the technology and the difficulty was every bit as complex as landing something on the moon. And we understand intuitively that going out into space and landing something on the moon has inherent risk, risk that you can't ever eliminate. But for some reason, we had this idea that you could drill down 3 miles below the surface of the ocean into these incredibly high pressure and incredibly explosive and flammable oil deposits that have been sitting there for 10 or 20 million years without any risk. I mean, we really came to believe in our own press clipping, so to speak, that our technology had become so great that basically this was not a risky enterprise. It's every bit as risky as going to the moon.
Do you feel that another drilling disaster is inevitable from all of the research and your time spent on this, learning about this?
Well, think about it. I mean, what happens if that, you know, we go every year we go without a disaster, and let's say we go 10 more years, and let's say we go 15 more years. Every hour spent out there basically costs $1 million. It costs $1 million per hour to drill, and they're drilling 24 hours a day. This is an incredibly expensive proposition. And everything they always have choices between spending more money and making it a little bit safer, or saving some money and making marginally less safe. So the longer they go without a disaster, the better the argument is for saving some money and taking a few shortcuts. And ultimately, at some point, they're going to take one shortcut too many, which is what happened in the case of the Deepwater Horizon, and there's going to be a disaster. I mean, it is just inevitable.
Oh. Well, your book has such a different take on the Gulf Oil disaster. Can you share one or two stories about the captain or the crew that really affected you?
Well, in the book, we go all the way from, our idea was to kind of make this the history of the Deepwater Horizon, which at the time it was built in 2000, 2001, was the most technologically advanced industrial machine ever built. And at the time it cost $500 million to build. And it was built in Korea. And so we decided that what we were going to do was we were basically going to do the biography of the Deepwater Horizon from the moment it was first conceived and then constructed in the Hyundai Heavy Industries shipyard in Ulsan, South Korea, until it burned and ultimately sank on April 21st, 2010. Some of the things that really affected me was there was this guy working for Halliburton, which is this huge, of course, mega corporation. But in this case, they were making the cement and serving as technical advisors to the installation of the cement in the well. And a well, you understand, isn't just a hole in the ground. It's more like building a skyscraper bigger than the World Trade Center down in an inverted skyscraper. It's an incredibly complicated structure. And the thing that keeps it safe is having an absolutely solid and secure cement job that you're trying to do the cement, you know, 3 miles below the surface. So it's a very technologically complex undertaking. And there was this guy named Mark Haffel, who worked for Halliburton, and that he was running these simulations, and he suddenly realized that the way that they planned to pour the cement in the final part of the well, this was it. They were going to finish off the well and leave. And he realized from the simulations that the cement was going to fail. So he like raises the red flag, and the engineers from BP sort of huddle with him, and they basically pull an all-nighter trying to figure out a way to save the cement job. And that they finally come up with a way to save the cement job, and they sort of they file a new plan, say, okay, this way we can do it. And they get this instant feedback that it's going to take too long, which means lots of extra money, and it's going to cost too much. So they told him, no, go back to the original plan and find a way to make it work. So, I mean, and in the end, though, he had to just sort of suck it up and figure, well, I can't fight City Hall, so to speak. So that, you know, that whole incident was, it was very dramatic.
11 people died, right?
Yeah, 11 people died. And the story of one of those people is a big part of the book, because he was on the crane and he was trying to get down when the explosion knocked him to the floor, and he was unconscious, at least, you know, possibly already dead, but possibly not. And the chief mate was trying to rescue him, and the crane operator was a big, big man. So at first he gets up to him and he like tries to carry him off, and he can't because he's too heavy. So he runs back to get help. And then he finally gets help. I mean, there's all sorts of chaos breaking loose. They lost power. They were trying to restore the power. They were trying to decide whether to, you know, separate from the well. And so he goes back and he gets help finally. And then he goes back, and right as they see him, right as they're getting close to him, this huge explosion blows a whole wall of fire between them and the guy. And they're like sitting there, unable to get there, looking through the flames, trying to figure out, is there another way to go, and realizing that there isn't, they have to leave him and abandon him. That's when they go to the life rafts. Well, I think that in order for us to, you know, we're all right now, like it or not, dependent on oil, and it's really urgently important that we be less dependent on foreign oil. And so for the moment, at least, looks like we're going to go ahead and try to develop our offshore resources. Well, if we're going to do that, we really need to understand better what it takes, how amazing it is what these people do, how much risk is inherent in it, and to understand it much better than we have. We just sort of are like tend to ignore it and let it go on without, you know, sort of figure, well, it's being taken care of. I think we're all obligated to know a little bit more about it. And that was really what we were trying to do with Fire on the Horizon.
And readers, Tom and Schroeder has done an amazing job on this book. You need to pick it up. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks, Lynn.